suddenly. A hot spatter of half-spent acid drops, 8 holes in Nona's smock and her skin. The wristband fell away.
That took a lot.
Nona shook the vial. Most of the contents had been used.
Make your blades!
Nona tried, straining the non-existent muscle that sat at the back of the mind. Her flawed blades pushed into being, shimmering out to their full length, vanishing, appearing again, unstable. In Keot's sight, the blades were a blue-white that was almost painful to look upon. Nona made to slice the other wristband off, but the blades melted away from it, refusing to cut just as they had once refused to cut Raymel Taxus.
Sigil protected.
Burn it open!
Nona shook the vial.
Not enough.
Her fingers sought the lock on her collar, hoping it would be smaller. It wasn't. She lifted the vial.
You will waste it. It is not enough, you said.
Nona's fingertips found the sigils on her collar, 3 of them. She fell back against the assassin's corpse, tilting her head. Gritting her teeth, she spilled the acid across the sigil marks. Searingly hot trickles ran down onto her neck, and Nona cursed, tearing pieces from her smock to wipe them away. She kept still, though, letting the acid hiss and bubble, eating at the metal, pitting it. The ship heart's presence reached her as the acid spoiled the sigil's deep-cut perfection. Not the full measure of it, but some of that old pressure she remembered from the convent, fingering in past the fractured wards. Familiar, but different. This wasn't the Sweet Mercy Shipheart, but another, beating with its own rhythm. Nona tried to see the path, but the collar's damaged sigils still blocked her way like a thicket of thorns. She felt the poison closing her throat, driving her heart into a frenzy.
Find the cure!
She looked down at the vials. Too many of them. She wasn't sure what had been on the blade. Fevercut would race the heart to destruction. Bitterwode would strangle. Redwort would paralyze with pain. It could be any of those, all of them, or something else. And to identify the antidotes by smell and taste alone.
Nona!
Another voice in her skull. Not Keot's.
Come to me!
And as the pain from Nona's broken ribs turned from unbearable to incandescent, magnified by the venom in her blood, Nona leapt from her flesh to Kettles. Chapter 35. Nona found herself running, awkwardly careening from one side of the uneven natural passage to the other. She understood that she was in Kettle's mind once again, but not why Kettle was staggering as if drunk, nor why she couldn't hear even a whisper of Kettle's thoughts. The unlit passage hid no secrets from Kettle's eyes, and yet she still managed to stub her toe against a ridge of rock and go sprawling clumsily onto all fours. The pain from Kettle's foot was small compared to what Nona had left behind, but she still swore at the shock.
Bleed on it!
Kettle remained on all fours, looking from one splayed hand to the other. She wiggled the fingers of the left hand.
I'm doing this,
she raised her head.
Me! Nona! Nona! Nona!
Her voice echoed. The sound of distant running reached down the tunnel into the silence that followed. People were coming.
Oh, hells!
Nona stood Kettle up, finding the length of her somehow disorienting, even though they were of a similar height now. She ran her hands, Kettle's hands, over Kettle's body.
Where are you?
The sounds of pursuit grew louder, closer. Nona patted her unfamiliar body once more, then set it running again, concentrating on the task of not tripping over her own feet. A task that had somehow become very taxing. 10 steps later on, she tangled her legs on Kettle's scabbarded sword and fell again.
Help!
Nona got to all fours again. Her legs felt too long, her top unbalanced, She spotted a sinkhole, a stone gullet just wide enough to take her. Kettle's dark sight revealed no bottom, just a near-vertical shaft plummeting away. Nona hesitated. Shouts rang out. Not far away, she thought, though the echoes could play tricks.
They're hunting me. Where are you, Kettle?
She could jump down and risk being trapped in a narrowing rock throat, a gift for the lightless, who could either winkle her out or leave her to die, or run on, slow and falling, to be overtaken and killed within minutes. There's a paralysis in choice, especially when what's at stake is more precious to a person than what they own. Nona risked her own life with frightening regularity, and without hesitation, but tasked with deciding how to save Kettle from the inside, she found herself frozen.
Kettle?
Kettle's whole world was pain, a white sea of hurt. With enormous effort, she uncoiled and forced her eyelids to part. She blinked. The world looked wholly alien, the colors strange, stone, alive with fire. Her eyes burned too, as if rubbed with pepper. She lay in a corridor, the floor awash with blood. The Noiguan, who seemed to have supplied it, close enough to touch. The assassin's flesh looked black. Her black skin mask dark, but with glints of gold as if something brilliant swam beneath its surface. Kettle struggled up and sucked a breath through a throat that felt narrower than a straw. The hands she used weren't hers. One wrist bore a metal cuff. The tatters of a smock hung around her nakedness. Her ribs screamed at her.
I'm in Nona. Somehow I'm in Nona as she was in me.
Kettle raised a hand to her face.
I lifted her hand. I did that.
A spasm clenched her stomach into a knot of pain, curling her around it, and her throat sealed completely. Kettle clutched at her neck, Nona's neck, frantic. A moment later she felt something like a scalding hand that clenched her throat beneath her own useless fingers and somehow opened it again.
Get up! Do something! You are as useless as she was!
A harsh voice, like that of an ancient, neither male nor female. Nona? It wasn't Nona.
You are dying! Move!
Kettle drew a throttled breath and crawled to the Noiguan. Her jacket had been cut open, exposing the antidotes and poisons she carried.
Pain? Weakness? Strangulation? What poison? Think!
Kettle's memory surged, carried with her into Nona's empty mind. She heard Apple's voice, the lecturing tone she reserved for class. You have close on 100 of choices for blade venom, unless, of course, you want it to stay potent for more than a day. Then you have only a score. If you also want it to have a chance of disabling your opponent before the fight would have ended naturally, then you have only a dozen. If you want it to be something people can't build up resistance against too, then you have fewer still. If you want to source the ingredients locally rather than bring them halfway around the corridor, there are five.
Five choices. Pain. Strangulation. It has to be blue scorpion. But weakness? Varnish of boneless? You can build resistance. Maybe that's why Nona can still move.
Kettle began opening vials in an ecstasy of fumbling. Stoppers popping off, contents spilling. A splash of the wrong poison on her skin, and her problems could be compounded. The Grey Sisters had ideas about the Noiguan's scripts, theories, but the Noiguan rotated their ciphers, and Kettle would rather die because she was failed by her senses than because of an error in translation. The Greys had training in sniffing unknown compounds, not just for a day, or two, or a week. Kettle had been drilled with her two fellow would-be sisters of discretion for a solid month. A month during which she came as close as she ever had to disliking, even hating, Apple. Two sniffs, one at a distance, one close. Then decide, and if you think it's safe, take it. The distant sniff gave a first and vital impression, and a chance to survive any trap. Neuguin, in particular, were known for packing a tube marked with some or other antidote, in cipher, with grey mustard, which when inhaled would eat away your lungs. Blind eye! Kettle wheezed a breath and tossed the vial aside. Cramps! Another tossed. Blue scorpion! A sharp scent, and the stuff inside looked viscous. Spread on a blade, it would dry to a clear coating like a resin varnish. White blood. The first antidote, but no use. Four more, three unpleasant poisons, and an antidote to the blind eye. Her throat tightened again so that each breath was sucked in with a wheezing rattle. Her heartbeat was now so fast it practically vibrated in her chest, and the effort of keeping her arm raised was starting to defeat her. And the pain. It made death seem welcome. If she had the air in her lungs for it, she would be screaming.
Hurry!
The stranger's voice in her head. In Nona's head. The next one had that sharp, almost lemon smell that made Kettle's gut roil. Proper lemons, grown at vast expense in the orangery of some lord, had a smell that made her mouth water. But somewhere between proper and almost, something went very wrong. It was the red cure. Kettle would bet her life on it. The mixture had to be prepared much like the black cure, but lacked some of the more dangerous ingredients, and included a couple of others specific to counteracting the scorpionoid venoms. Kettle bet her life on it. With the last of Nona's strength, she lifted the vial to her mouth and tipped in the contents, trying not to choke as they leaked down the constricted passage to her stomach. Nona lay deep below the tunnel she had first found herself running through. The narrow sinkhole had swallowed her. Gravity had pulled her over yard upon yard of slippery rock, a sinuous near-vertical descent, weaving around harder intrusions of igneous stone. The passage growing narrower, starting to grip Kettle's body on all sides. Nona raised her arms, and just as she thought she might become wedged, her heels found a ridge. She had slid down so far that the sounds of her pursuers no longer reached her. Nona held her breath and listened. She couldn't imagine any lightless so dedicated to the hunt or so scared of failure that they would voluntarily lower themselves feet first into the stony throat and allow themselves to be swallowed too. Nona stood, clutched by the cold rock, damp, shivering. Alone in the deep blind dark, yet seeing. The darkness pressed on her, and into her. Nona understood the power she held over it, here in this body. But more than that, she was vulnerable to it too, in new ways. The dark was neither empty nor kind. She felt the shadows flowing through Kettle's flesh in a way that she hadn't on the previous occasion she had shared her body. This time was different. Kettle had gone. Given a moment to think, Nona remembered where she had fled from. Somewhere not so far away her own body lay poisoned. Dead by now, surely. She would go back if she could, but there seemed no way to do it. She sensed no connection. An awful suspicion rose through her. Somehow Kettle had taken her place along the thread bond. Somehow Nona had allowed it when she had weakened the sigils that walled off her power. Nona reached for the echoes of Kettle's memories, hoping for some clue. She ground Kettle's teeth with concentration and forced the most recent recollections to the surface, sifting through them with the fingers of her mind. Kettle had been hiding, waiting where she came to rest after her long flight from the fortified tunnel. Judging the passage of time can be hard when you're alone in a dark place, far from the sun and moon. But the sisters of discretion have their ways, and Kettle had sat her first day and night in silence. At some point, she had slept, dipping into that feather-light and dreamless sleep in which those of the grey are trained. Kettle had spent time remembering, without pleasure, the long, arduous weeks of her instruction on remaining alert. She had endured those weeks in the Undercaves, as had a trio of other candidates for the Grey. It had been her first trial on reaching Holy Class. Saphira was one of her three companions. Sister Apple and Kettle's classmates had made scores of attempts to take her unawares, day and night, creeping to the cavern where she waited, coming at her from any of five entrances. She had to last 6 days. If anyone managed to touch her without challenge, then the count was reset. The 6 days started anew. If she hadn't managed the 6 days before the month was up, she would never have worn the grey. Sometimes they came at her every hour, or twice in 5 minutes. Sometimes they left 2 days. The longer gaps were the worst. Nona shook herself out of Kettle's older memories, searching for something fresher, and almost immediately found a memory of Kettle lifting from her shallow sleep, eyes opening to the darkness, clarity descending as she strained to hear again whatever had woken her. Some faint sound reached her, a pebble sent tumbling by an insufficiently cautious foot. Distant, but not distant enough. Kettle had risen silently and started off down the tunnel she had scouted. She sped up, started to run, and suddenly her head had split with incredible pain. A hot rush of fear flooded her. She saw visions of a burning world and knew Nona was in mortal danger. Forgetting her own plight, she had reached for the novice. And somehow, this... Chapter 36 Abbess Glass. Brother Pelter's rapid success in acquiring the services of Senior Inquisitors Seldom and Agica had been followed by frustration. Pelter chased one report of Inquisition activity after another, only to find the operations completed, the Inquisitors departed, or the report exaggerated, and the investigation lacking sufficient importance to have a Senior Inquisitor in attendance. On their infrequent returns to the swift toll roads, the paved thoroughfares that constituted the Empire's spine, Glass had seen an unusual number of grand carriages hastening east. Great wheeled confections of ebony and silver thundered by. The devices of many of the greatest Cis families blazoned on their sides. On several occasions the Abbess had managed to catch a good look at the coat of arms flying past her window slats. Black axes crossed before a red sun. The ancient house, Rolsis. The tower and quill of House Jotsis. And the hangman's noose of the Galampsis. Swift climbers and relative newcomers to the highest circle. They had travelled on, ever east. From her carriage window, Abbess Glass had seen more of the Empire in that space of days than she had seen in the last 15 years. She had always maintained good lines of information, from the Grey Sisters and the Red, but also from a dozen and more old contacts. People who had been her eyes and ears when she sat in the highest chair at the Tower of Inquiry. The tower overtopped all of Verity's spires, and the view was a commanding one. But its mistress had needed to see further still. Even so, the carriage journey had reminded Glass that nothing beats seeing and hearing it for yourself. The gossip of trader and merchant, farmer and soldier, even subdued by the sight of Inquisition robes, offered up the pulse of the Empire.
"We'll soon be there, Abbess."
Brother Pelter had taken to repeating the reassurance with greater frequency as the delays mounted. The white peaks of the Grampians dominated the skyline, lending weight to Pelter's claim. He sat between the Senior Inquisitors Agica and Seldom on the bench opposite Glass, no kindness in his smile.
"Soon be there."
Pelter thought he was threatening her. But Glass now hoped with all her heart that their hunt would end soon. The world held many kinds of magic, but the greatest of them, it seemed to Glass, was timing.
Do you think that Shazal coming to power would be a good thing, brother?
Glass asked.
She has already come into power, Pelter said, and it is good for those who support her.
Shazal is hunting more than a seat at her brother's table. She's collecting ship hearts. The harm she could do...
To others?
Pelter snapped.
The harm she could do to others? Wisdom in such times lies in knowing who to follow when things fall apart. You, Abbas, have been unwise.
Wisdom lies in not allowing things to fall apart, brother.
Glass's gaze flitted from Seldom to Ajika.
We are all part of the Ancestor's Tree. A twig that breaks free will, however advantageous the wind, fall and wither in time.
Pelter called a stop in the village of Brew, at a ramshackle tavern named the Elusive Pig. He commanded that lunch be served for his party, and placed another brick of penitent's bread before Glass. She sat, chewing the coarse slice that Sarah, applying her guard's sword to the purpose, had cut for her. And while Pelter asked after Senior Inquisitor Hames, who supposedly was investigating the heretical reinvention of some would-be lordling's family tree, Glass listened to the chat at neighboring tables. Individuals, families, and whole clans had arrived in Brew, and in-lying villages all along the corridor in past months, all of them displaced from the margins by the advancing ice.
"More came in last night."
The speaker, two tables away, had a rumbling voice that slid under the general chatter, each word like a boulder rolled out for inspection.
"They says as how these beggars are coming in from the margins."
A narrow-faced merchant opposite Rumbler, dark-complexioned and sour.
"They says it wrong, though. We're the margins now."
"We'd better toughen up then and protect what's ours,"
Rumbler said.
"Harder than nails, those frost farmers are. Poorer than Hope Church mice. What they going to do when they get hungry?"
"They're hungry now."
"Well, they won't starve quietly in the road, I'll tell you that for nothing."
At the table behind Glass, the patrons were, with voices amplified by ale, discussing both the Scythrol threat and the Derns.
"Piss drown the Derns! What do we care about Empire Ports 300 miles west of us? They're closer to Dernland than they are to us. Let them fight it out on the beaches. Derns and their little boats."
The speaker spat mightily, giving her companion a chance to break in and air his opinions.
"Jaiselina hunts white lion up on the east slopes. You want to listen to that man? See clear across the border from those slopes you can. He says you can't hardly spot the ground in Scythrol. There's that many battle tribes gathered. A dome'll have them over the passes before the year's out. Mark me. Like a tide. A red tide. Beggars off the margins won't matter then. Derns won't matter then."
"She wants the Ark, they say."
A third voice. An old man, Glass thought.
"That's what the Battle Queen wants."
"That's what they say. It's always about the Ark. Me? I think it's about land. They want acres. They want our acres, and they're happy to water them with our blood. Once they got the land, they won't give three whistles for Crucicle peering out of the Ark at them."
Glass sat back, her gaze on the table, immune to the malice in Pelter's glances, listening. Perhaps 5 minutes later the sea of voices from which she fished her gossip fell to near silence. Glass lifted her gaze and turned, like almost everyone else, to see three large men in furs and iron come through the inn's main door. Jurigs, like the Pilarthi in the north. In the south, the Jurigs reigned largely unchallenged as the fiercest and most feared of the tribes that stalked the ice margins. Unlike the ice tribes, they did not want to live out on the sheets, nor could they survive there long, but they could certainly retreat 10 or 20 miles onto the ice when Empire troops threatened, then march east or west to reappear unannounced, weaving down between the crevices on a glacier's back and abseiling from the heights where the moon's focus sheared off the ice's snout. The Juregs scanned the crowded taproom, wolves eyeing the flock. To either side of glass, Pelter's guards, Melkir and Sarah, quietly slipped hands to sword hilts. Adjika and Seldom exchanged glances. Juregs were known for taking clergy for ransom. Even if a packed inn discouraged them from immediate action, the chances were that they would follow the carriage when it left. The Juregs ignored both bar and fire pit, plotting a straight line for the Inquisitors. The crowd of villagers, farmhands and travellers standing in the main room melted out of the men's path. Melkir made to stand, but found his chair wedged beneath his legs by that of a portly cloth merchant behind him. The largest and eldest of the trio, a solid 6.5 foot tall, broad in the chest and sporting a wild beard shot with grey, offered them a discoloured grin.
"You're claimed. Come."
He gestured to his companions, possibly twin sons.
"Leave your guard, and we won't hurt him."
Glass met Sarah's eyes. The Juregs adhered to a bizarre patriarchal version of the ancestor faith that relegated women to a menial status barely higher than that of slaves. They kept the trappings of those beliefs in the language they used with outsiders, but sadly were not so committed to their principles that they would ignore armed females such as Sarah. They would underestimate her, though. Even so, the life of an Inquisition guard was a soft one compared to one spent raiding on the ice margins. Glass would be tempted to bet on any single one of the three Juregs against both of Pelter's guards. Despite that, she would urge both guards to fight. She had a timetable in mind, and the delays thus far had been welcome. But being ransomed by the Juregs would take weeks and ruin everything.
"Up!"
The older man clapped calloused hands together. As adherents of a heretical strain, both Juregs and Pilarthi would set high ransoms for Inquisitors and harsh deadlines. Putting an Inquisitor to a gruesome end was said to please a Jureg almost as much as being handsomely paid to let them go.
"I don't think the nun wants to go with you,"
a man's voice from behind the Juregs. He sounded gently amused. The tribesmen turned together, the two sons reaching for their swords, the father with his hand resting on the haft of his axe. Glass saw that the speaker was a surprisingly young man, not as tall as the Juregs, and of considerably lighter build. He wore a travelling cloak of good quality, held a nail tankard in one hand, and the strap of his travel bag in the other. The dark eyes beneath the scroll of his black hair mirrored the amusement in his voice, as did a crooked smile on his narrow lips.
"Not your business, lad. Dying will be your business if you don't step back."
The senior Jureg spoke with rasping malice.
"Make me."
The smile broadened, showing white teeth. One of the sons stepped forward, drawing his sword. The man released his ale and bag, dropping as fast as they did, and sweeping out a leg that took the son's feet from under him. The speed of it was breathtaking. The man surged up faster than the son came down, stepped inside the other son's sword blow, and punched him in the throat. Somehow he had the father's knife out of his belt and pressed into the thicket of his beard before Glass properly formed the thought, "Hunska, full blood." Two more Juregs appeared in the doorway, halting when they saw the problem. The young man walked the Jureg leader towards the exit.
"I'm sure the gentleman can find another tavern to drink in."
He waited for the sons to pick themselves up and leave. The other two men backed out of the door, and once they were both through, the Hunska returned his prisoner's knife to its scabbard so fast that Glass barely saw the flicker of his hand. The Jureg took the point and left without bravado. He could roust a tavern every day for the rest of his life and not meet another Hunska Fullblood. Pride was one thing, but no raider got far on pride. Pragmatism was what kept you alive in the margins, and the Jurig had lots of it. The young man spoke to a couple of locals by the door, then returned to the table. There were no cheers. The villagers stared at him, as if he might at any moment burst into flame, or become a horse. Not until the last yard of his approach to the Inquisitor's table, his half-smile fading as he spotted Glass's silver chains, did a weather-beaten traveller call out in sudden excitement,
"It's him! I know him! From Verity! The Ring Fighter! Regal!"
Chapter 37 Abbess Glass.
"I'm surprised that we met on the back roads, given that you're bound for Shazal's palace."
Glass watched the young fighter, ignoring her bread. The Inquisitors, even the guards to either side of her, had much finer fare on their plates. The town of Hertel nestled among the Grampian foothills, and as the last civilized staging post for travelers visiting the palace, or forging on through the Grand Pass to Scythrol, it boasted several restaurants of passable quality.
"Those toll roads will bleed a man dry."
Regal took a forkful of beef from his plate. Despite his confidence, something in the action declared him an irregular user of cutlery.
"I thought ring fighters were handsomely paid, especially successful ones. And surely you must be successful to be known so far from Verity."
"I win more than I lose."
Regal shrugged, chewed, swallowed.
"And I'm careful with my money. It has to cover a lifetime. Nobody lasts too long in the ring. There's always someone getting better while you're getting worse. And when the time comes to quit, many leave the ring unfit for other work."
He cut more meat from the joint before him. The smell of it set Glass's mouth watering.
"Besides, I wanted to see something more of the Empire than what you can glimpse clattering along the toll road."
He paused, considering.
"That village, Brew, I came from near there, born in a barn. My parents sold me to a child taker."
The Inquisitors looked up at that. The Church of the Ancestor took a very dim view on any who would sever the bonds of family for as little as money. On the other hand, the fruits cut from the tree in such a manner were invaluable to the church. Children given to the monasteries and convents by a parent could be taken back. Those sold from their families and arriving later on the church's doorstep could not.
"Did you see them?" Glass asked.
"Them?"
Regal looked up from his meal, flashing her a dark glance from beneath his brows. Glass made no reply. They both knew what she meant. Regal returned his gaze to his knife and fork, cutting his meat ever smaller.
"My father died a few years ago. I saw my mother in the crowd that gathered when I rode in. She didn't recognize me."
Glass leaned back and let the young fighter pretend to concentrate on his food. Properly, Regal should not be allowed to address a prisoner, but Brother Pelter had needed him. The Inquisitor had engaged Regal as additional security, offering the promise of Shazal's gratitude as well as a handsome purse. Glass welcomed the company. Regal, for his part, once realizing that Glass had been the Abbess of Sweet Mercy, had been keen to talk about the blade training, then the Kaltus forging, and gradually, like an artist revealing their subject from a confusion of lines, Nona Gray. With her trial jury watching on, Glass knew she had to guard her tongue where Nona and her escape were concerned. She knew that keeping Regal happy and continuing to offer his protection was certainly among Brother Pelter's motives in letting him talk with her. But a stronger motive for Brother Pelter was doubtless the desire to give her enough rope to hang herself with. Even so, She told the ring fighter as much of the truth as she dared. Brother Pelter perhaps had never known the emotions that rule the young. He might claim that he was old enough to forget such passions, but Glass had as many years as Pelter, and her first love still burned bright among the dusty archives of her memory. They waited around forgotten corners, waiting to surprise her at the strangest of times. Glass saw, in Regal's careful dance around the missing girl, an interest she recognized. She saw a domino standing, others lined behind it. She saw the time to push it. "We always hope that other people will see past the skin and bones we wear, Regal. These masks we've been given. We hope they'll see us. Some spark, some flame, something special, something that's of worth. Some people are born without that sight. Some mothers find they lack it even when they look at their children. They are as crippled as the blind. Worse, perhaps. Your mother didn't see you when you returned because she had never seen you. I would know my Abel after 50 years unseen, though he were old and grey himself." Her fingers still remembered her child's hair. The clean scent of him as a baby still haunted her at unexpected moments, causing her breath to catch and her heart to ache. Glass watched Regal. He seemed still a boy to her. Young man he should rightly be called, but she could still see the lines of the child that Partness Reeve had purchased for the cultus. She had watched him, watched his sarcasm, the lightly mocking smile, the sardonic airs and assumed ennui. She knew armor when she saw it, and who wears such heavy armor if they are not vulnerable without it?
"All I know is my mother didn't see me, just the clothes and the horse."
"The fault isn't yours, boy." Glass picked at the penitent's bread. "She may lack that sight, but it's burning in your eyes, and you've seen the flame in others. In someone who could be precious to you." Later Glass would speak again of Nona Gray, of how she fled the Inquisition, and of the manner in which Lord Taxis had promised her life would end. Later, but not now. Under Regal's protection, their luck had turned within the day, and a third senior inquisitor, Brother Dimion, had been located and won to the cause. It hadn't been hard for Brother Pelter to convince him. Brother Dimion's antagonism towards the Abbess was well known. Glass had kept him on a tight rein and at a low rank during her tenure. Since her departure, Dimion's star had risen swiftly. With their party complete, Pelter had directed that they return to the toll roads, and the carriage had made swift progress. Their driver promised to have them at the palace by evening.
"Come!" Pelter placed a silver coin on the table and stood to leave. "Time we were going!"
Glass rose slowly. She broke a piece from the brick of penitent's bread before her and began to chew. The Grand Pass proved less grand than its name. Although the Grampians boasted no deeper or broader pass this side of the corridor, the Grand Pass was neither deep nor broad. The road grew narrow and wound its way up slopes of frightening steepness to gain altitude. With the increased elevation, the winds grew fiercer and colder. Ice clung to the rock and gathered in any hollow. The dark stone of the Grampians became white-clad, the carriage frost-bearded. They left the trees behind first, then the grass, until all about lay pale as death, unmarred by any sign of vegetation. Small forts studded the pass at regular intervals. Not primarily for preventing passage, Blenai's Fist served that purpose on the eastern slopes, but to house the soldiers who made regular sorties into the peaks, patrolling for Scythrol spies, or raiders, or the forerunners of any mass invasion. Smoke rose from behind their battlements, and firelight bled between their shutters, but still they looked bleak and isolated amid the vastness of the mountains, mere points of warmth and light scattered across an untold weight of cold stone. The wind ceased to moan and took up howling instead, running its teeth along the carriage's slatted windows. Ice fragments peppered the backboard, and the stronger gusts set the whole vehicle lurching first one way, then the other. Although all manner of perils lay ahead for Glass, she found herself at that moment feeling rather sorry for Regal, leading the way on his painted mare, sorry for Heb the driver, hunched in his seat, and even a twinge of sympathy for Sarah atop the wagon, whose job it was to cut her down should she try to escape. The sky above was a deep maroon, shading towards black, strewn with dark ribbons of cloud that looked like lacerations where jagged peaks tore the heavens. Despite the twisty narrowness of the route, the road they followed was not without traffic. The dimway lights of carriages, carts, and wagons punctuated the sinuous length of the pass, snaking up towards the highest point and the long descent that followed. And there, cradled and largely hidden by the arms of a side valley, a glow that might have risen from a small town, but instead hinted at the lights of Shirzal's lonely palace.
I would say that anyone who secretes themselves so high in such a forsaken place must be plotting something.
Glass continued to peer through the slats, speaking to nobody in particular.
But that might hold just as well for a convent atop a rock, or an inquisitor in a tall tower.
The three senior inquisitors dozing on the seat opposite made no reply. Brother Pelter only curled his lip, but Melchior, though he stiffened his face into the guard's mask, couldn't help but twitch the corner of his mouth in the direction of a smile. They advanced in fits and starts, seeming to halt at every second one of 100 or more passing places to allow wagons and carts coming in the opposite direction to go by. Trade flourished across almost every border in the corridor. Any closed border sealed off the world to the east, from all nations to the west. The pressure that then built to reopen such a border grew rapidly, and was exerted by a growing number of nations, starved of whatever delicacy or local rarity their people craved. And as conflict threatened, trade boomed. Merchants, suddenly desperate to stockpile goods that might not be available again for long and bloody months, even years. Glass had no real basis for comparison, but given how many heavily laden wagons they were having to stop to let pass, she guessed this might be a boom. To many of the Sis, Shirzal's decision to isolate herself amid the Grampians had seemed like madness. Granted, the Emperor's youngest sister had also taken herself to the very edge of the Empire. But Valyra's palace lay in the thriving port of Geryn, a city that had few equals in terms of wealth and society. Shirzal's palace was, by necessity, more of a fortress, at least from the outside. In fact, it had been a fortress before she took command of it and set her masons to work. The Grand Pass offered no hospitality, no concessions to the frailties of humankind. For grounds and gardens, Shirzal had windswept rock. Her home's reply to the constant gales was to offer only slit windows, and few of those. The Emperor's eldest sister lived behind thick walls of dark grey stone, quarried from the mountains themselves. Her palace squatted between the arms of a side valley, seeking shelter, with only three towers brave enough to push above the sullen bulk of stone. High walls enclosed a courtyard in front of the main palace. Glass watched through the window slats, as guards drew open the huge gates and ushered them within. No plumes and pomp for the hardy souls manning Shazal's door or patrolling her battlements. These were soldiers, dark-cloaked, armored veterans who had known both victory and defeat. Wheels clattered over flagstones and crunched over gravel. The driver brought his horses to a stop. Sarah opened the door, and Brother Pelter stepped down into the swirling wind. Glass followed with Melchior holding her elbow to steady her on the step down. She took in the scene. Constructing a level area wide enough for the scores of carriages now lined up within Chazal's courtyard must have been the largest feat of engineering involved in the whole project. The Emperor's sister might have taken herself away from society, but clearly she had intended from the very start that society should come to visit, and in numbers. The emblems, resplendent in glowing colors beneath rain-beaded varnish, announced a gathered throng of unmatchable pedigree. Glass hadn't time to catalogue many before two footmen descended the steps from the grand portico and begged that the esteemed inquisitors follow them out of the wind. And so Glass, together with her guards, her accuser, and her judges, climbed Chazal's marble stairs. They passed beneath the arched doorway, leaving the wild night behind. The great door clanged shut behind them. For a moment, inquisitors, guards, and prisoner stood blinking, adjusting to the sudden warmth and absence of wind. The brilliance of scores of crystal lamps bathed the vaulted hall. Statues lined the walls, members of the Lancist dynasty, proud, regal, dwarfing all members of Glass's party, emperors side by side with those who never sat upon a throne. Between one statue and the next lay a niche, each hung with a crystal lamp and displaying a single object fashioned by artisans, some ugly, some exquisite, all of breathtaking value simply on the basis of the kind and weight of the materials from which they were made. Servants came forward to take the Inquisitor's coats. Others went out to collect luggage, while a butler, an older man with an impressive mane of white hair, established the credentials and business of the new arrivals. Inquisitors are seldom welcome at parties, even when the host is the Inquisition's prime instigator. From what Glass could catch of the low-voiced conversation between Brother Pelter and the butler, it seemed that their arrival was expected, and that contrary to decorum, they were invited to join Chazal's gathering immediately. Glass knew that Chazal's parties typically lasted a week or more to allow for the uncertainties of travel, her guests often being far-flung. She would accommodate a sizable fraction of the Empire's nobility, providing scattered entertainments during the day with grand balls and banquets to crown each evening.
"We're road-stained and tired," Brother Dimion grumbled.
A big man with an unhealthy pallor and puffy flesh, the Inquisitor had proved a poor traveller, clambering from the carriage at every pause to stretch his back.
"I want a room, clean robes, and a rest."
"I concur," Adjika nodded. Her hair was in disarray after dozing against Brother Seldom for the last 2 hours of their journey. She hid a yawn behind her hand. The butler relented.
"Leon and Noel will show you to your rooms, Inquisitors."
He paused.
"But the Honorable Chazal was insistent that your prisoner be brought before her on arrival."
"I will present her,"
Brother Pelter said. With a motion of his hand, he invited the senior inquisitors to follow the servants to their rooms.
"I'll come too," Regal said, showing his smile.
"They'll expect a ring fighter to look like a ruffian."
His black cape sparkled with melting ice fragments, and he smelled of wet horse. Glass imagined him striding in among the bejeweled throng in Chazal's hall and found an echo of his smile on her lips. A glance in Brother Pelter's direction wiped all humor from her mouth. The palace opulence might make it easier to forget why they were here, but the narrow malice on Pelter's face allowed no doubt. He wanted to see her burn. Chazal's guests were already gathering before their banquet. Scores of the Sis moved in loose groups between three huge reception chambers. In one, a gallery held several musicians, and the gentle tones of harp, finial, and flute drifted across the conversation. In another, acrobats performed feats of balance and strength, largely ignored by the glittering crowd. And in the third, dancers twirled, pulsing to the soft beat of drums. The butler led Brother Pelter and Glass with deft surety, navigating the sea of silk and diamonds, gold and brocade. Sarah followed with Melchior, their services wholly unnecessary, but perhaps calculated to add an implication of guilt and danger, in case any should miss the Abbess's chains. Any crowd can be a lonely place, but Glass knew that those who have experienced a hostile crowd would choose loneliness in an instant. In such a place, there was always someone at your back. Hard glances, sharp comments, laughter behind hands. The church abjured its flock to be humble, but it was hard to hold high office and not grow accustomed to the respect it brought. Glass had worn that authority and approval like a cloak for many years. It had grown around her, slow and insidious, but now it had been stripped away in an instant. She felt diminished, naked. An old woman paraded for show and mockery. She kept her head high, but her body lied. A last defense against the humiliation Shazal must have planned for her. However, of all their party, it was Regal, following the two guards, who claimed the most attention. Glass was grateful to have the focus taken from her. It seemed that more of the Sis frequented the cultus than anyone might suspect. But then again, few families rose to such heights without having at least a little taste for blood. Recognition, greetings, and invitations rang out where the ringfighter passed, though none would mistake them for friendship. He was a novelty, and winning his company would reflect well on the lord or lady who drew him to their circle.
"Regal!"
a young woman's voice raised in pleased surprise.
"How fashionably late you are!"
Glass glanced over her shoulder to see a tall young woman in flowing green satin insinuate herself into the Hunska's path.
"I came to protect your virtue in such company. Surely only the Dernsea has more sharks."
"But none with such white and even smiles."
Regal made a half bow while slipping to the side to pass her, a fighter's move, and left her in his wake. Terra Mensis. Glass knew the family, though the girl had been 11 the last time she laid eyes upon her. Glass had hoped for the child's sake that she would grow into her nose.
"Abbess Glass?"
A large figure loomed out of the crowd, and Glass turned to find herself facing a great lord robed in imperial red, with the snow lion trim that only the head of a Sis household might wear before the Emperor.
"Lord Jotsis."
Glass inclined her head. She should have expected the Mensis to be near the Jotsis in such a gathering. Carven Jotsis she knew of old. A good man, honest, bold, lacking in the subtleties his forebears possessed. Unfortunately, it was those subtleties which court life required if a house was to flourish.
"It pains me to see you in such circumstances, Abbess."
Carven bowed his leonine head. Brother Pelter hovered in the background, the irritation on his face not quite brave enough to escape as words of reprimand.
"Holy Mother!"
From around the broadness of Carven Jotsis came Arabella Jotsis, hair a cloud of golden curls, a vision in blue silk and taffeta, neckline plunging, waist tight, presenting a softer aspect to the hard warrior's body beneath. The girl dropped into the lowest obeisance of the novice, one offered only when at greatest fault or to an archon, high priest, or statue of the ancestor. Her skirts billowed, then pooled around her. All around conversation fell away, Sis heads turning.
"Get up, Ara."
Glass found her eyes misting.
Whatever are you doing here?
Ara looked up, her own eyes bright with tears. But it was Lord Jotsus who answered.
Forgive my niece, Abbess. My brother removed her from Sweet Mercy after the recent unpleasantness. Temporarily, I'm sure. I thought it too soon for a return to society, especially here. But the girl insisted, and my brother has never managed to stand up to his women.
Carvin coughed and glanced across the crowd, looking for his own formidable wife, no doubt.
Still, it sends a message, no?
Glass nodded, and smiled as Ara rose beside her. The message sent, that the Jotsus fear no one, was rather undermined by the fact that many knew Shirzal's interest in Ara had evaporated on discovering that Nona filled the Chosen One's shoes still better, and then that Zol met all requirements. Perhaps the true message was one of peace rather than defiance, and by sending both, Carvin's brother had demonstrated some of that necessary subtlety the Lord himself lacked.
Glass!
Brother Pelter found his voice, staring pointedly at Sarah and Melchior. Glass ignored him.
Ara? I came to be of service, Abbess Glass,
Ara said. Although her maids had made her beyond pretty, with all the arts of powders and rouge, there was still something in those blue eyes that promised a world of hurt to any who crossed her.
You have only to ask, and I'm not alone.
She motioned with her gaze, pointing out Darla, who towered above her father, the renowned General Rathon, newly promoted, and surely just one more victory from his lordship. Glass found herself oddly touched that the two novices had contrived to have their family connections move them to her destination as soon as they had discovered it. The delays encountered while Pelter hunted her judges had allowed Darla and Ara to overtake her along the more direct roads.
Heretic!
A vicious whisper, close at hand. A glance found the source decked in diamonds and lace. Joelle Namsis. Her whisper spread, giving license to tongues held still in the moment.
Abbess Glass!
A malicious smile.
Were chains all you could find to wear that would get you past the door to so grand a home?
This girl wasn't 17 yet, but she could pass as a woman of 21 among the gathered heiresses.
And I had heard that you were supposed to be good at these games of empire.
Glass!
Pelter again. The abbess turned away from Joelle, nodded to Lord Jotsus, and pushed on before Melchior's hand quite found her elbow. The butler pressed forward, employing some personal magic to forge a path through the assembled aristocracy without causing offence. Ahead the throng thickened as cattle will around a feeding trough, the conversations joining and swelling, each voice raising itself by degrees in order to be heard. Like a Marjal water worker, the butler parted the vivid sea before them, and revealed at its midst, Shirzal in flowing black.
Abbess Glass!
Her already wide smile widened.
Have you brought my daughter to me?
Novice Zol's whereabouts are unknown to me. Glass studied the woman. Shirzal looked younger than her 39 years recorded against her name. Nobody would call her beautiful. Perhaps striking would be closer to the truth. Undeniably, the energies that animated her created a personal magnetism about the Emperor's sister.
A disappointment.
Shirzal managed to hide the alleged disappointment from her face.
And you come to us in chains.
All eyes save Shirzal's fell to Glass's wrists.
Are we to have a trial? How exciting!
Glass raised her wrists, palms turning upwards, and drew the crowd's gaze back to her face.
A trial without inquisitors would be impossible, I'm afraid. And it would be remiss of me not to note that Brother Pelter is here illegally, along with Brothers Seldom,